All right, welcome to the second podcast, Digging Deep podcast here in my office at CLU. My name is Rahul Deep Singh Gill. I'm a professor of religion, associate director for the Center for Equality and Justice, and I am the professor of the three lovely young minds that I have in my office today. I have Chris Wolf. Say hey, Chris.
Hey, how's it going? I'm Chris, philosophy DA here at CLU in Dr. Gill's Global Religions class.
What would you say about my class?
Very open and insightful.
Yeah, you really get an like A. All right, I got Jamie Morris. Super. What's up, Jamie?
Hey, how's it going?
Jamie's also in the Global Religions class. I won't put her on the spot unless you want to be on the spot.
No, I mean, I think it's challenging and transformational.
Whoa! A+. I got Blake Philo. Philo or Philo?
Either one. Most people flip-flop in between those.
And you're comfortable with either one.
I'm comfortable with that.
I like that about you, Blake. Blake is also a philosophy major.
And a poli-sci.
Oh, double dipping.
Yeah.
And any opinion on the class so far?
If I would try to use one word, it'd be revitalizing.
What? Really?
Yeah.
That sounds like an energy drink.
It does, doesn't it?
Or like a really good conditioner. You know what I mean? Like for your hair.
Well, I think I was a little worn out on religion and that this class kind of helped it bring it back into a better light.
Okay. So the class that we're all talking about is the class we're all taking together. I feel like I'm taking it along with you guys. Introduction to the Study of Global Religions. And as part of our class discussions, we've been talking a little bit about the concept of interfaith. People getting together, dialoguing, serving from different faith communities together. And Chris here found an interesting article on Salon.com, Chris?
Yep, Salon.com.
So what was the article that you found? What brought your what got your attention about it, and why did you bring it to our attention?
Well, it was this guy, Chris Stedman, who is a pretty active interfaither, but he's also an atheist, a pretty strong atheist.
Right.
And he said he was looking for some kind of community among the atheists, but what he found when he actually found that community was not what he had hoped to see.
Yeah.
From his understanding of atheism, he had hoped to find a little bit more openness and willingness to be compatible with each other and, you know, for open discussion. But it seems that when he went to this conference, this gathering of atheists, he was almost ganged up on for being what they labeled him a faithist for giving too much credence to other faiths.
And religions and working religions, with people from exactly. Religious backgrounds and service settings. And so, Jamie, I'll jump in here and say, first of all, Chris Stedman, we know Chris Stedman, and I.
Yeah.
From,
well, he came on campus.
He did come on, he spoke on campus last year.
Which was really cool to hear about, especially his new book, Faithiest, which is where the article comes from.
By the
Beacon
book.
Beacon Press. There we go.
2012, hot, the album just dropped. Okay.
But also, I know him and we know him through Interfaith Youth Corps that we're a part of. And he spoke at the Leadership Institute. Both here in California as well as in Illinois.
So this discussion is interesting because two of us are actually pretty committed to the concept of interfaith, right. And two of us are actually kind of
atheistic.
Yeah, atheist.
I would say I'm an atheist.
You're an atheist, and you're kind of questioning the concept of interfaith. Is this even possible? Can you do it?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, I think there's a great ideal in interfaith that, you know, everybody should be open and we should be willing to accept or at least, if not accept, at least understand other people's beliefs. But, and even though I'm probably to some degree an atheist, you know, I would agree with Stedman that I see a lot of atheism as militant, you know, and not willing to accept that.
And so the problem that Stedman is coming up against is that, like, for example, he says that he's at a party.
Mm.
And he starts talking about sort of kind of sympathetic to, from a sympathetic perspective to certain religious believers.
Yeah, I have a quote here. He says, when people were talking about the extreme fundamentalist thinking of certain religions, he says, "I understand what you're saying, but how can we discount the role that religious beliefs have played in motivating the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. or Mahatma Gandhi?" So, I mean, he's understanding the importance that religion plays for some people, for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But, you know, even at these remarks, you know, most of the other atheists scoffed at him. Oh, you're one of those atheists.
Right.
You
one know? Of those.
Exactly.
Faithiest. Mm-hmm. So you're not legit. You're not a real atheist because you're giving credence to this illogical belief system of religion.
Mm. Well, that's very prevalent in this new atheism. I mean, I say I probably came my atheism prior to any of this new atheistic discovery that I had during school. Like, yeah. I learned of Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris.
So you were on it before it got hot.
I was on it before it got hot. I was, in the Catholic. I was born Roman Catholic, did that whole kind of thing. And I remember sitting there, like, one of my grandfathers is actually a Sunni Muslim, so I'd always think, like, somewhere this got, like, mixed up, you know? Like, yeah. I'm a Catholic now, but some of my family is Muslim.
Right, how did that come to pass, yeah?
Yeah, so I was skeptical beforehand, but you do bring up a good point that these new atheists, they have this militant way. Like, I think that when you do come into atheism, the first four people you usually hear about are these four horsemen, and I think it's because they are so outspoken. So,
Hitchens,
Dennett, Harris, and Dawkins.
I never heard of Dennett. Who's that?
Daniel Dennett. He's, I don't know if he's as outspoken as some of them, but he's also a philosopher and atheist, and he was a part of the group that Richard Dawkins had started called the Brights.
Yeah.
And this is where some of that militant stuff starts creeping up, too, is that they started making groups of atheist people. And this one was called the Brights, and it had this air of arrogance of, like, we're better than everyone else, right? Even with the name.
So do you think that's the core problem here, that Chris Stedman is up against, this kind of arrogance?
I think so. I mean, if I can find a quote in here, he was talking specifically about, you know, people who say that they are the only ones with the right outlook.
That sounds familiar. That sounds like religious people.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So they're recapitulating the same problem that they're kind of fighting against?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and what was really fascinating to me was that Chris Stedman himself said that, you know, he used to be an evangelical Christian, and then when he chose to be an atheist, that he had that same, you know, religiously intolerant feelings as a lot of atheists and the new atheism has. So it's really interesting to see how he was that and now he's all about interfaith.
Right.
I think that might be a side effect too of discovering your atheism. A lot of the time I think people leave theism with kind of a sour taste in their mouth. It's like, I'm out of this clique, you know, I'm not a part of this anymore.
Right.
And I think that does add up a little bit to the vehemence of these people, is that they're kind of attacking you because it, like, with my feeling of Roman Catholics especially, is I feel like I have a little bit more of a availability to criticize them because I came out of that religion. But the more and more I leave it and kind of, like, get to my atheism, you do see these, like, you can become a religion and you can be like, you know what, you are not, like, I can't believe you believe those things.
Right.
You can start thinking that way.
And Stedman's point is, now with this new atheism, it's not just religion that leaves a sour taste in your mouth. Now even atheism is leaving that sour taste because it's being just as equally militant and divisive and vehement, so on and so forth.
Now, even though these four horsemen might be so vehement and their language is maybe a little over the top would be easy to say, you think that we could just totally discredit them, though? I think that they're still pretty credible.
Well, yeah, they certainly have good points, but it's not specifically the four horsemen and these scholars of atheism that he's talking about. It's this community of new atheists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people don't attack religion at its very basic principle. A lot of time they go for the community and what the community has corrupted it to do. And I think that's also what he's addressing here.
With atheism,
within the atheistic community and the way that they're approaching the religious community.
So maybe it's like how you see there's always, like, the right-wing Christian who's always saying stuff, and maybe he doesn't even know his own Bible verses that well. Maybe he's not that educated with the material, and he's just kind of defending it everywhere. I think that's somewhat what these new atheists are like, too, is that they're just defending it because they don't know it that well yet. Back to the Four Horsemen, a lot of these guys just get their information from these guys. And there's a new term coming out called a YouTube atheist. And that's where most of these people get all their information from, YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Huh. So this is a mode of getting information.
Mm-hmm. And if you look up atheism on YouTube, in the first slides, I guarantee you're going to get one of the four horsemen.
Yeah, we should do that Google search.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting. I think one of the interesting things about the article is that Stedman is actually so honest about his own story. And I'm interested to buy this memoir because his story is just so interesting, you know. He doesn't come from a totally religious family, gets into evangelical Christianity through social networks, right? And I think that's part of his movement, because he doesn't go to evangelical Christianity because he really, really believes it. He kind of gets there because they offer him pizza and a family when he comes from a kind of a broken home. And so he kind of finds community in religion, right? And I think his story about finding, of then coming out as a gay man and then coming out as an atheist as well, I don't know which came first, but finding a community again amidst religious people is actually a really interesting part of his story. Mm-hmm. And Jamie, you're coming from a religious background,
yeah.
And you found a community in interfaith as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really cool to see how interfaith works coming from a religious background where, you know, like I'm evangelical Christian. So, to see that, well, how do we get along amidst our differences? Like we can believe different things. But what's more important, you know, making the world a better place or sticking to your beliefs no matter what? No one else could ever have anything to say in the conversation.
Yeah. I also came to the interfaith movement through my own religious beliefs. You know, in college, we had this chapel at the University of Rochester where I went to school, which is a pretty radical chapel. It's called the Interfaith Chapel. One of the people who donated the money to Rochester didn't want any kind of religious affiliation with the school, but yet there was a need for some kind of spiritual home, and so they built an interfaith chapel technically off campus but directly across from the library. So it's an interesting statement about, you know, the library's, you know, academic mission directly facing this chapel's interfaith spiritual mission. And I was one of the coordinators for programming for interfaith there. So I came to interfaith through my own sort of religious and spiritual seeking. But sometimes parts of me is kind of a little bit unsure about the interfaith movement. Can you guys vibe with that as sitting on the outside from a religious perspective?
Yeah, I can chime in. I mean, when I read this article, you know, my first reaction to the interfaith movement that he's, you know, praising so much here, this is awesome. You know, everybody wants unity. Everybody wants acceptance among all people. That's obviously something we all strive for. But, you know, when I started thinking about it a little more, started wondering, you know, if it's almost not too subjective to the point of not being critical enough to acknowledge the fact that there are many religions that do produce divisive and vehement claims towards others. And so I think that the challenge with interfaith is to be communal and unified and accepting of everybody while at the same time being critical of all the things that religion can do.
And so you're saying one of the things that sticks out like a sore thumb to you is that interfaith seems a little bit blind to the divisiveness that religion does cause amidst people. Is that what you're saying?
It can be.
Blake?
Well, I like the concept of interfaith a lot. This whole, like, it's almost like the pantheon with Rome, like how they had all the different religions, but for them you still had to say Caesar was, you know, number one over everyone else.
Uh-huh.
The only thing that I run into is the relativistic claim of if you guys are all saying everyone's right, then who's really right and is your individual religion? What happens to the credence of your individual religious ideas then?
Right. Jamie, do you think interfaith today, as it stands, this wave of interfaith that we're kind of involved in, is saying, well, everyone's right and everyone has their own truth?
I think the more recent interfaith movement would say no, that we don't believe in the same God, or, you know, some of us don't have believe in God at all.
Yeah.
But it's more saying, so now what? you know, how are we gonna live in our world together? I mean, we live in the most religiously diverse nation in the world, and the whole world is becoming more globalized. So, how do we make this work? How do we build relationships with each other? And even in, like, amidst disagreement, how do we still make the world better?
I think that the community formed by interfaith is, like, I mean, you guys are striving for that whole kind of like the hippie message, you know, peace, love for everyone kind of thing.
You think so?
I don't think so.
I mean, it sounds very one love kind of thing. You know, like, let's get everybody on the same earth loving each other despite our differences. And that is awesome. And back to the whole community thing with the atheistic side, there's a bumper sticker that Austin, one of the kids from our class, always loves to point out to me.
What's up, Austin?
Yeah, what's up, Austin? How you doing, bro? He likes the flying spaghetti monster one, too. I don't know if you guys have seen that.
Austin's into some weird stuff. I don't know everything Austin's into.
But the bumper sticker says, I'm not religious, but I envy people who are. And I think that's getting at, I don't have a religious community, and I envy people that do have the community.
Yeah.
And Kierkegaard, he said this more
whoa,
about...
Whoa, whoa, you're bringing philosophy into this?
Yeah, some Christian existentialism.
Word.
Soren Kierkegaard, he said it more about believing all in overall, but he said an atheist is a theist by night.
Oh.
And I think that is true to some extent, that I miss community, man. I miss going to church sometimes and having those people I knew were going to be at church.
Yeah,
I miss the thing that we all used to do together at church. You know, I miss those things that are lacking when you leave religion. And I think interfaith, I actually can't say too much, but I think they are trying to get that back, trying to bring that to light, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I just think of the Leadership Institute, where we had a seeker talk about her faith and saying that...
This was the Interfaith Leadership Institute that you did in Philadelphia?
In Philadelphia.
Over the summer... With a couple other CLU people.
Correct.
It's run out of the Interfaith Youth Corps out of Chicago, Ibu Patel's group.
Correct.
So what was the seeker doing?
So the seeker was talking to us a little bit about her faith and saying that it's true. She missed out. She's been looking for community, and that interfaith plays that role for her. So I think you're right. It could totally be a place for people who might not experience community in that same way to maybe identify with a group of people.
Well, Stedman put it really nicely in the, do you have those last pages you had me read? Pretty much the last thing he said was, I think, very humanist opposed to just atheist. It said, if such a label institutes that I'm interested in both, and he's talking about faithism when he says label, if such a label insinuates that I'm interested in both exploring godless ethics and identifying and engaging shared values with the religious, I'm putting faith in my fellow human beings and our shared potential to overcome the false dichotomies that keep us apart.
Dichotomies. Yeah.
Thank you.
No problem. That's what I'm here for.
And then I'm all for it. So he's saying that, I think that's a good way of saying that he's a faithist. He's a faithist and that he has faith in humankind.
Yeah. And he is a humanist. He's actually one of the chaplains for the humanist religion at Harvard University.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so humanism is big on that. Mm-hmm. Does that speak to you, Chris?
It does, especially what Jamie was saying about establishing this community. I think that's really the strength in interfaith, particularly because that's one of the most important aspects of religion. You know, if we've learned anything from your global religions class, it's that religion is not just about doctrinal beliefs and practices. It's about the community that it establishes and the way that its practitioners can relate to one another. And if interfaith can create an even larger community among believers, maybe not believers of the same thing, but believers in general, you know, then that's a victory for them.
And this is the part, this is where I get a little skeptical and a little worried, and I kind of don't know how to move forward. What about those religious peoples to whom the concept of interfaith is itself some kind of selling out, or itself is selling short their religious cause? I mean, are those people just existing in my head, or are they out there?
I almost see it as like the reaction to globalization.
What do you mean?
Like, interfaith seems like it's bringing in all these aspects of the world that were just for like the last 30 years unavailable to everybody. But
so, like how?
Like, you had more conservative versions of these religions. Like, I think in America, we weren't even at that point yet, 30 years ago, to have something as big as this interfaith thing. I actually don't know when it was established.
Yeah, the 60s is probably the time when people felt that ecumenical, you know, reaching across ecumenical lines and faith lines was important. And I think Vatican II makes a statement about ecumenicism and within the Catholic Church reaching out. But I should I should check my history on that.
Yeah, the Second Vatican Council.
Right? Okay.
Right.
Cool. Yeah.
Well, there's also, I think that some people that are opposed to this interfaith thing, like globalization, is it's a dilution of a pure culture.
Yeah.
Like, you do have to compromise a little bit. I don't think we can sit, I don't know, I'm not a part of interfaith, like I keep saying, but I don't know if you can have a fundamentalist Muslim in your group. You guys might be accepting of him, but he might not be accepting of you guys. Uh-huh. And vice versa. I don't know what his actions would be like, but it's like, at what point do you have to compromise some of your own religious views to be in this interfaith movement?
I mean, and ideally, you wouldn't have to dilute anything.
Right.
But
it's hard. It's super hard. It's really even hard for me when I have to talk to people in my church about it who don't know anything about interfaith, are freaked out by it, because they're like, well, how do you do it and not, you know, want to convert everybody, you know?
So take us through one of those conversations. What where do you go to church, and what kinds of things do you have to address with people when you talk about interfaith?
Sure. I go to a Foursquare church.
Uh-huh.
Charismatic, evangelical.
Yeah.
And I love it, but it's just, it's hard to talk about it and say, oh, I'm really involved in interfaith. Where you get to collaborate with people of different faiths and you get to work together. The tension that's there between affirming other people's religions while also staying true to your own, there's real tension there. And I don't even know if I've got it completely figured out, but it's true, there's tension.
Would you say that this might lead to maybe the evaporation of tenaciously grabbing onto your own beliefs? Like, maybe what if the interfaith church was around for another like 20-30 years?
Well, it's not a church. Mm-hmm. Right, it's a sort of delocalized movement. Mm-hmm. Several movements, maybe even. Yeah.
Does it meet like a church? Is there like meetings or?
Well, the interfaith youth court, do you want to explain it?
Well, the IFYC specifically, they have chapters on campuses, especially college campuses. The whole point is to serve together. Their three tenets are voice, engage, and act.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about, you know, engaging with each other's stories while in shared action to benefit the community. Yeah. But there are all different types of interfaith. That's why this gets kind of messy, because interfaith can have the connotation that we all, oh, there's really only one God. Like, we all totally believe the same thing. And but IFYC says something different, that we can hold our individual identities
parallel. When I was in college, the model for interfaith was dialogue, right? So what you would do is everyone would get into a room and talk about, well, I believe this, and I testify to this, and I don't like it when you stereotype me in this way. And so dialogue was the core mode of action. The IFYC put service at the center of that. And I think that was a really interesting shift.
Mm-hmm.
But this is where I want to push back against you, Blake. I'm not so sure this is a hippie movement where everyone's, you know, peace and love and we're all the same. I think this is this new, so if there's a new atheism, there might be a new interfaith that is kind of cognizant of these tensions. Mm-hmm. And man, it's hard. It's hard to walk this path.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that it's hard for all these people within interfaith to reconcile the overall belief of tolerance? Is that what?
Not just tolerance, but not diluting one's own belief system.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, and with new atheism, it's definitely, they're not diluting anything.
Right.
I mean, they're coming out.
That's straight vodka, man.
Yeah, and Christopher Hitchens, it would be scotch. You know, he'd be sipping on his scotch, and he'd be, I mean, telling. There's interviews with him where he's too drunk and he's like just droning on.
Oh, literally, he's a Scotch guy.
Yeah, he's a Scotch guy.
He was. Yeah,
He passed away. But I hope that it's not just feeding off each other. Like, this new interfaith is going to get really like interfaithy because the atheists are really getting vehement. But I do kind of side with Chris, and it's kind of, I reluctantly say this because I do view Christopher Hitchens kind of as like a little idol of mine, but I wrote a journal for you this week for our class, and it was called A Certain Four Charismatic Leaders, and where I do a case study, and we did a case study on Jim Jones and on Tibetan Buddhism.
Right? Tibetan Buddhism was a larger case study, yeah.
So I did it to the Four Horsemen and specifically Christopher Hitchens. And when you look at Christopher Hitchens, he is ripe for worshiping. I
mean, so you're saying Christopher Hitchens was himself kind of a charismatic figure,
oh yeah, definitely,
that created a cult following.
Mm-hmm. Even more within any of the Four Horsemen, I think he stands out because he's the most outspoken. He's awesome to listen to. I mean, he's a great linguist, but I think that he does get your blood boiling. You're not going to leave his debates with a calm, with like, oh, I learned a bunch calmly. You're going to be like, I learned a bunch, you know?
Yeah. So, or darn it, I'm angry.
Yeah. Right. And it depends on the way you're going to take it and internalize it. I think that some of these people that Chris Stedman ran into, these militant atheists, they hear these kinds of outspoken atheists and take it to be this, like, mobilizing thing. Like, I better go out and tell the next Christian that they suck.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And that's the bummer. I think Stedman wanted to see these ideals of interfaith, you know, unity, you know, working together, everything. I think he was expecting to see that in the community of atheism. You know, he expected them to be an educated, hopefully somewhat scholarly group of people who were willing to accept to some degree, or at least be tolerant of other beliefs. But what he found specifically at this conference that he went to was that most certainly wasn't the case. You know, he goes so far as to call this new atheism toxic, divisive.
Well, in Hitchens' defense, everything he says is going to be divisive. I mean, he could be talking about public school education on the elementary level and say something that, like, really bums people off. You know?
He pisses people off that can't be pissed off otherwise.
Yeah.
But it's interesting and ironic that you think that he might have developed a cult following that is quasi-religious.
I mean, I don't want to use the word religious just because it's atheistic, but I would say that it's definitely there. It's idolatrous. Like, they are looking at him as, especially because he just passed away.
Mm-hmm.
In my own regard, I took the philosophy of atheism course. I found out who he was, and I got to have this kind of like intimate YouTube relationship with him. There's so many YouTube.
I'm sorry. Did you say intimate YouTube relationship?
Yeah, I guess that was the wrong word. But like, you actually feel like he's your friend, you know, like he's, especially if you're atheistic.
I don't think it's the wrong word. I think that's really interesting. I think that's really interesting. And it's really interesting that even religions, I mean, televangelists are YouTube evangelists, you know, like I feel like this is the new medium, but that's another conversation for another day.
Well, and you can look at, I just saw a YouTube video. I don't get all my information about atheism from YouTube, but.
Okay,
know.
I'm glad. Wikipedia, right? That's a much
better. Yeah, Wikipedia is the other one.
Right, thank you.
But there was a video of a girl responding to this YouTube atheism, and she's saying that people that only get their information from this only think there are these new atheists out there. They only think that there's this, like, really strong, iron-handed kind of atheism. And that's just not true. I mean, there's, you can go all the way back to like Lucretius, and it's like there's a very rich history of atheism that's just not this militant new atheism.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly what Stedman was trying to find and hoping to find in greater quantity among the atheistic community. And what he's trying to promote is these interfaith ideals in atheism.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, what he's found is just this particular group is just as militant.
Well, it's funny that he doesn't like Harris so much. He uses
Sam Harris
a few times. And another teacher in this hallway, Dr. Bursley, he knows Harris quite a bit. And we were talking to him a few days ago about Harris. And I actually got his book from Dr. Bursley. But what he says is he's kind of young and that he is very strident. Maybe it is because he's so young, like I just said. But it's, I think hopefully he'll come to a point where he's not going to be so in your face.
Yeah.
And he's one of the only four horsemen that believes in mysticism. Mm-hmm. He does not discount this feeling of spirituality. And he has this new book called The Moral Landscape, where he's trying to use science to determine morals, but he also has this chapter that factors in spirituality and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that he just doesn't, like, cut everything away.
I think it's interesting that we're talking about atheism as having evolved, because 40, 50 years ago, students of religion, particularly sociologists in Northern Europe and North America, were predicting the end of religion, or, you know, mm-hmm. like the collapse of religion. Science mm-hmm. is going to provide the explanatory model, and, you know, this religion thing, it's gonna pass.
Well, and Friedrich Nietzsche, he said God is dead, and that he said that the last man before the Overman, his famous Übermensch, can take place and really destroy the shadow of all gods and all places. He gave it an actual number, and I think that there's 70 more years that he says that an Übermensch can come and assert himself and get rid of this, like, last man Christian slave morality.
That's really interesting, because that seems kind of eschatological, apocalyptic, and religious.
Atheistic apocalypse, you know.
That's freaking me out. But why? I mean, why? What do you think it is about religion that actually, at the end of the 20th century, into the 21st, it's full on in resurgence across the world? What did these dudes who were predicting its demise miss about it?
I think, as we were talking earlier, it could be the community of it. You know, as I said earlier, it's not just about the beliefs and the practices, which is mostly what these philosophers and atheistic scholars, it's mostly what they attack. You know, they go to the beliefs and the fundamentalist, the texts and everything like that. But that's not all religion is for people. It's yeah. community. It's connecting with everybody, yeah. With the divine.
Yeah.
Whether you have to anthropomorphize that divine and, you know, make sacred something very specific, you know, that's up for debate. But if you can make religion personal, then it has much more power
yeah.
than they originally recognized.
Yeah, great. What do you guys think? I mean, sounds like a pretty good answer to me.
I think there's like a great awakening bandwagon that happens every, like, so often in our country. You know, we had the first great
awakening. Talk like an old man. You know that? You're like, oh, when I was young, we didn't have this problem.
I think it's because I come from a history major.
Uh-huh.
And my dad's a historian. Uh-huh. So I get a lot of this kind of talk and rhetoric at me, you know?
Yeah. Just so everyone knows right now, Blake is sitting in a rocking chair, has got a pipe in his mouth.
Yeah.
And he's drinking scotch.
I think that these, like, great awakenings come around every once in a while, and that even this, the moral majority movement could be called, I think it is the third great awakening. But what I see in all these movements of the great awakening is, like, you're moving away from these, like, institutionalized churches. A lot of these things are in, like, big fields, and Billy Graham did his in Madison Square Garden.
Yeah.
So I think that it is showing the community side more than the ritualistic institutional side. It's like, let's get everybody together in a big field and let's remember how great it is to feel as a whole.
Mm. And so that, like, kind of larger concert setting is actually really important for these religious revivals or reawakenings. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, believe it or not, we've been rapping for like more than half an hour.
Really?
Yeah. So, well, let's close this session up. So, interfaith, atheism, or religion? Last word. What do you guys... Pick one of those and tell me about its future.
Man, that's a tough one to pick the three. But I'd like to pick interfaith.
Okay.
I mean, I don't want to speak out of ignorance, but...
Speak.
I will.
But you're going to speak anyways.
I know that Chris Stedman said that he's a faith-theist and that he's part of this interfaith kind of thing. As an atheist myself, I've never researched interfaith yeah. and those kinds of things. And I would think that it would be crucial for the future of atheism to look into interfaith. Mm. And maybe for interfaith to look into atheism, see if these two things are compatible and on a larger scale and if we can work together. But,
wow.
I mean, just how we were saying within the religious, not like religious differences, there needs to be compromise. If you throw atheism into the mix, the whole bag of atheism, you know,
yeah.
You, mm-hmm. there's going to be a lot of compromise that's going to have to be made on both sides.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Jamie?
I'll choose religion.
All right.
Future of religion. I think it's growing. I think worldwide religion is just spreading like fire, or has already been established and is continuing to grow. And so I think future of religion means figuring out what it looks like to hold your own identity in parallel with someone else's.
Ooh, that's beautiful. So, tension. like yeah. holding those tensions between people,
yeah.
or within yourself,
right.
and your neighbor,
right,
is what you think is the next
right. All right, learning how to do that well.
All right,
yeah.
Chris Wolfman Wolf, you get the last word, my man.
All right, kind of piggybacking off what Jamie said, I would go with interfaith for much the same reason. I think that people need to learn how to hold that tension a little better, you know, among different faiths and belief systems, things like that. And the other thing I think interfaith needs to do if it's going to survive is to not be overly subjective. It's the one thing that I see as just a gaping problem that if they don't address, it's going to swallow them whole.
Can you explain to me what overly subjective looks like and how do you not be overly subjective?
Well, if you say, oh, everybody's equal, everything's all good, accept everybody's viewpoint, you know, if you're over-tolerant, you're going to be skimming over some pretty blatant wrongdoings, possibly, that religion has committed. I mean, terrorist bombings, you know, extreme religious fundamentalism, things like that. These are problems that need to be addressed. And I think that the risk of interfaith and being overly subjective is not addressing those problems when they need to be addressed. So if they can find some sort of objectivity and kind of bring that into the interfaith, then I think it's a great way to go.
All right. Well, you heard it here first, people. Digging Deep podcast, keeping you in the loop. These kids got to get out of here, got to get out of my office and go do their homework because they got a lot of it.
True.
True.
No complaints, but I give you candy. All right. Thanks, guys. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you.
Not a problem.
Thanks.
Peace.